This is VOA News via remote. I'm Tommy McNeil. U.S. President Joe Biden marked the Tulsa massacre in an emotional graphic speech. We get more from AP correspondent Mike Gracia.
The Biden administration formally ended the Trump-era migrant protection program.
This was not a riot. This was a massacre.
100 years later, an American president finally spoke to the horror of the Tulsa massacre that saw the thriving Greenwood District, also known as the Black Wall Street, destroyed.
The mob terrorized Greenwood, torches and guns, shooting at will.
On May 31st and June 1st, 1921, a white mob swarmed, looted, and burned Tulsa's Greenwood District. As many as 300 black Tulsans were killed. Afterwards, thousands of survivors were for a time forced into internment camps. In his remarks, Biden said the nation must come to grips with the following sin of denial.
For a long time, schools in Tulsa didn't even teach it, let alone schools elsewhere.
I'm Mike Gracia.
China's government says that its chief trade envoy has talked with Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen, but it gave no indication when negotiations on ending their tariff war might resume. The Commerce Ministry says that Vice President Liu He and Yellen, talking by video link, discussed the economic situation, bilateral cooperation, and other issues of mutual concern. Gave no details, though. U.S. President Joe Biden, who took office in January, has yet to say what approach he will take to the conflict launched by his predecessor, Donald Trump, who raised tariffs on Chinese imports over complaints about Beijing's industrial policy and trade surplus. This is VOA News. A ransomware attack on the world's biggest meat processing company is disrupting production worldwide. AP correspondent Sagar Magani explains.
It comes weeks after a similar incident shut down a U.S. oil pipeline and left some people scrambling for gas. This time, the target was JBS of Brazil, which has extensive facilities in the U.S.
We're assessing any impacts on supply, and the president has directed the administration to determine what we can do to mitigate any impact.
White House spokeswoman Karine Jean-Pierre says the Biden administration's talking directly with the Russian government after JBS said the attack came from a group likely based in Russia. The company says the hackers affected servers in North America and Australia. Sagar Magani, Washington.
The World Health Organization validated Tuesday the CoronaVac COVID-19 vaccine developed by Chinese pharmaceutical company Sinovac Biotech for emergency use. WHO recommends the vaccine for use in people 18 years of age and older in a two-dose schedule with a spacing of 2 to 4 weeks. That's according to a statement. The efficacy results showed that the Sinovac vaccine prevented symptomatic disease in 51% of those vaccinated. Also prevented severe COVID-19 and hospitalizations in 100% of the studied population. That's according to the WHO Strategic Advisory Group of Experts on Immunization. The World Bank President, David Malpass, said on Tuesday that it is vital that the United States frees up excess COVID-19 vaccine doses for Latin America. Malpass also said that the World Bank now has $12 billion in COVID-19 vaccine financing available and will have approved vaccination financing operations in over 50 countries by the end of June. Amazon now says that it will no longer test job seekers for marijuana use. The e-commerce giant, which is the second largest private employer in the U.S. behind Walmart, is making the change as several states legalize cannabis. In March, a New York man sued Amazon, saying the company rescinded his job offer at an Amazon warehouse because he tested positive for marijuana. That came even though the city banned employers from testing job applicants for marijuana last year. Amazon says it will continue to test workers for other drugs and conduct impairment checks on the job. It also says some rules may still require marijuana tests in line with Department of Transportation regulations. Via remote, I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Wednesday, June 2nd, and here are some of the stories we are covering. A Ugandan government minister survives an alleged assassination attempt.
The attackers came from the back and from the front, and they were firing. So he got out and engaged the ones at the back. They ran away and engaged the ones in the front. But the one in the front was very determined to come back and finish whatever he had started.
Kenya's 58th Madaraka Day celebration characterized by political drama. Egypt's foreign ministry complains about more Ethiopian dams on the Nile River. Somalia's Journalist Federation unveils a lab to combat misinformation, and the date is June 17 for the return of former Ivory Coast President Laurent Gbagbo.
For his family and also his political family and most of the Ivorian, it is a grateful event that he's come back into the country. You know, Mr. Gbagbo, he is one of the key of the reconciliation in this country.
And the Senegalese military bombards rebels fighting for independence of the Casamance region. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Uganda's Minister for Works and Transport narrowly escaped an assassination attempt on Tuesday that claimed the lives of his daughter and driver. The minister, who also is a general of the Uganda Defense Forces, was injured. Catherine Nambi reports from Kampala.
Attackers on motorbikes apparently trailed General Katumba Wamala's official ministry car, then opened fire, killing Katumba's daughter and driver instantly. The general managed to make it out of the car with bullet injuries on his arms. Jacob Olanya is the speaker of Uganda's parliament. He says, according to eyewitness accounts, the assailants were repulsed by General Katumba's bodyguard.
So the attackers came from the back and from the front, and they were firing. So he got out and engaged the ones at the back. They ran away and engaged the ones in the front. But the one in the front was very determined to come back and finish whatever he had started. So when he got and engaged with him, now he also ran away. Because the car was already down, he had to call the general and take him to some place. They entered some, all the, everybody locked their doors, so they had nowhere to hide until he found some ramshackle place. Then they took cover there. Then he came to check whether those attackers were still there. And of course, other people now came to help.
Olanya says that Katumba is out of danger and receiving treatment for his injuries. From his hospital bed, General Katumba Wamala has been recorded in a video making social media rounds, assuring the country and his family that he will get well soon.
God has given me a second chance. I'll pull through. Don't worry, I don't have bad injuries, only the arms, but I'll be fine.
Okay.
I'm with the doctors, and the doctors are doing everything possible. Okay.
Flavia Abiekwaso is the army spokesperson. She says investigations into the shooting have commenced.
The investigators know that, definitely. They'll have the threads. They will have the links. We already have links. We already have phone calls that were made, phone calls that can be traced.
The attempted assassination of General Wamala follows a number of other high-profile assassinations by assailants on motorbikes. In 2017, a police spokesperson and his bodyguard were shot dead in a similar manner. Other incidents include the murder of a state prosecutor in 2015, murders of a number of Muslim clerics gunned down in different parts of the country, and the murder of a member of parliament as he approached his home in 2018. In most of those cases, the attackers have not been found. This is Catherine Nambi for VOA News in Kampala.
Kenya's 58th Madaraka Day celebration yesterday, Tuesday, was characterized by political drama. Madaraka is celebrated every June 1st to commemorate the day that Kenya achieved internal self-rule. During yesterday's celebration at the Jomo Kenyatta International Stadium in Kisumu, President Uhuru Kenyatta openly criticized the judiciary in what some observers say was an attempt to influence the outcome of the Building Bridges Initiative BBI case in the Court of Appeal. Atieno Odhiambo reports from Nairobi.
In the presence of newly sworn in and Kenya's first female Chief Justice Martha Koome, President Kenyatta openly criticized the judiciary. He said the judiciary sometimes delivers judgments that are costly to the nation,
From the nullification of a presidential election in 2017 to an attempt to stop the will of the people as expressed through the BBI, the judiciary has indeed tested our constitutional limits. Their decisions must consider the letter of the law, but fundamentally, the spirit of the law must also guide them. I say so with all humility because the spirit of the law is the light that will illuminate the burden of the choices that they make. The judiciary should be guided by the spirit of the law, and political stabilization will be easily achieved.
The judiciary now finds itself at crossroads with the pending appeal on the BBI case expected to start today, Wednesday. President Kenyatta warned that failure to amend the constitution would doom the economy with an estimated loss of 30% of the national budget every 5 years. He said those opposing the BBI bill are doing so because they cannot imagine a better Kenya for all.
If BBI were to be stopped, who carries the burden of choice? On whose shoulders will ethnic majoritarianism rest? And who will carry the burden of losing 30% of our national budget every 5 years due to the toxic politics that BBI sought to resolve? Everyone knows that the BBI is good. It's good for our country. It is even good for those people who are unhappy with it. But too many Kenyans have embraced fear of change over the need to continuously strive for a more fair, just, peaceful, cohesive, and democratic Kenya. They oppose the bill sometimes not because of its substance, which even its harshest critics concede is good, but because, unlike our founding father, they cannot dare to imagine a better Kenya for all.
It appears President Kenyatta and his deputy William Ruto are no longer reading from the same script when it comes to running the government. Ruto, in his remarks, defended the judiciary, emphasizing the need to respect the independence of institutions. He said a robust legislature, a performing executive, an independent judiciary, and other independent institutions are a firm foundation for the rule of law.
Our forefathers worked hard, toiled, shed blood, so that we can have a democratic nation, a nation anchored not on personalities, but on constitutionalism.
A robust legislature, a performing executive, an independent judiciary, and other independent institutions, so that we can all celebrate the firm foundation of the rule of law, not the rule of man.
President Kenyatta and his new political ally, opposition leader Raila Odinga, unveiled the Building Bridges initiative as a remedy to 9 key areas that need reform identified in their 2018 ceasefire following a divisive general election. Atieno Odhiambo, VOA Daybreak Africa, in Nairobi, Kenya.
The Egyptian Foreign Ministry complained on Tuesday after the Ethiopian Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed indicated that he was planning to build 50 small dams on the Nile River, despite the fact that there is still no resolution over the ongoing conflict on filling the Renaissance Dam along the Nile on Ethiopian territory. Edward Uranian reports from Cairo.
Egyptian media broadcast an angry statement by Foreign Ministry spokesman Ahmed Hafez criticizing Ethiopian Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed's declaration about building 100 new small and medium-sized dams on waterways across his country during the next year. Hafez indicated the plan is a sign of Ethiopia's ill intentions regarding the conflict over filling the Renaissance Dam, which has caused the casus belli with both Egypt and neighboring Sudan. Hafez added that Ethiopia must coordinate such plans with its neighbors before causing them damage. Egyptian President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi visited Djibouti last week, insisting during a press conference he was still hoping to negotiate a diplomatic solution to the conflict with Ethiopia over filling the dam. Sisi says he discussed the Renaissance Dam situation, which affects the interest of the entire region, and the need for a fair and balanced agreement over filling and operating the dam as soon as possible, and Egypt's refusal of the effort of any party to impose its own plan that doesn't meet the interests or rights of countries whose interests are affected. Egyptian political sociologist Saeed Sadiq tells VOA the issue of Ethiopia filling the Renaissance Dam for a second year starting in July has provoked the wrath of the Egyptian public.
Public opinion is very angry and is pushing the government to react to the provocation of Ethiopian politicians and media who are all the time speaking in a very provocative way against the Egyptian people and the Egyptian government.
Sadiq went on to say that Egyptian opposition forces based mostly outside the country were calling for protests over what they claimed was the government's mishandling of the crisis. Sadiq added that Egyptian officials were perplexed over the unwillingness of influential foreign power brokers like the European Union, the United States, and the African Union to use their influence to reach a diplomatic solution to the crisis. Paul Sullivan, a professor at the U.S. National Defense University in Washington, tells VOA that Ethiopia's construction of the Grand Ethiopian Renaissance Dam is inflaming enough, but building 100 more dams creates greater incitement and is an accelerating aggression. He goes on to stress that Egypt will need to respond, and if Ethiopia wants peace, they are giving indications of just the opposite. If this comes to war, he argues, all will lose, and massively. He says a reasonable settlement would be ideal, but that things seem to be going in the opposite direction. The Egyptian military has been conducting maneuvers with a number of regional countries in recent days, including Sudan, in order to show its readiness in the event a conflict erupts. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Wednesday, the second day of June. The Federation of Somali Journalists has launched a disinformation lab to combat the spread of false information, fake news, hate speech, and propaganda. The group says Somalia is already seeing a huge spike in social media misinformation campaigns ahead of elections expected before the end of July. Mohamed Kahir reports from Mogadishu.
The country's chronic internal conflict and political instability has made Somalia a fertile ground for the spread of misinformation. The growing number of young Somalis who connect and share news on social media platforms has become a prime target for this tide of fake news. One example is a news headline that said the Somali parliament wanted to ask the prime minister after he objected to a time extension for President Mohamed Abdullahi Farmajo. It later turned out to be a fake news. To curb the growing challenge for media workers in the country, the Federation of Somali Journalists has launched what it calls a disinformation lab to curb the spread of lies, myths, and distortions ahead of upcoming elections. The lead researcher and director of the lab, Mohamed Abdul Malik, says they will give journalists the necessary skills and knowledge to detect fake news during the polls.
The lab's researchers will support journalists and media workers in Somalia with digital tools, training, and other resources necessary to detect, analyze, and debunk false election-related news in near real-time fashion. In a fragile environment where trust is so low, safeguarding the election process from fake news is as crucial as saving Somalia from descending into civil war again.
Journalists, key bloggers, and social media influencers in Somalia say there is a need for extra caution during the presidential and parliamentary election process.
As journalists, bloggers, and social media influencers, we have an extra responsibility, especially during elections, to inform the public about the crucial process. Thus, we need to be very careful not to run news that are not verified, because it will be irresponsible. Better late news than fake news.
The Somali government, which has poor record when it comes to press freedom in the country, says it will play its part in reducing fake news during the polls by giving access to journalists in voting centers so they can get first-hand information. Abdulrahim Issa Addo, who is the director of media training and the minister of information, says the ministry will also boost awareness campaigns about fake news through the state media and in collaboration with the civil society groups and religious leaders. Meanwhile, Somali political leaders have appealed to the media to perform their duties professionally and responsibly. As the Horn of African Nation gears up for what promises to be a competitive presidential election. Mohamed Kaye for VOA News in Mogadishu, Somalia.
The UN Refugee Agency says some 350,000 people affected by the volcanic eruption in Goma are in urgent need of assistance. The UNHCR office in Goma, speaking on a video link from Goma, describes the prevailing situation in the city and in areas outside the affected zone where people have taken shelter. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
Mount Nyiragongo erupted on May 22nd, turning the sky a fiery red and spewing lava into nearby villages. More than 30 people were killed. Fears of a second volcanic eruption caused a mass exodus from Goma of most of its 450,000 residents on May 27th. Around a quarter of that population fled to the neighboring town of Sake in the eastern province of North Kivu. The UN Refugee Agency left behind a team of 9 people in the area to evaluate the needs of the displaced. The agency and partners immediately began distributing plastic sheeting, water, and other aid. The head of the UNHCR office in Goma, Jackie Keegan, says she and her team since have returned to Goma. Speaking on a video link, she describes the situation in the city as one of uncertainty and unease.
Yes, I'm scared of the aftershocks, of course. Less scared now than I was when the windows were shaking every minute, which was happening about 4 days ago. But yeah, it's scary. We're living on an active volcano. Like everybody else who ran away from the volcano, we are trying to figure out how to be as useful as possible in a challenging time.
The International Organization for Migration reports the eruption has displaced more than 415,000 people, nearly half of them minors. Most have traveled to towns in the eastern DRC, while roughly 52,000 have crossed the border into Rwanda. IOM spokesman Paul Dillon says about a quarter of those who have fled Goma are very vulnerable and in need of special aid. These groups, he says, include breastfeeding women, the chronically ill, pregnant women, unaccompanied children, the elderly, and the disabled.
Should the displacement last, it's essential that we consider how we're going to prevent the spread of epidemics, facilitate humanitarian assistance, and get kids back to school. IOM is particularly concerned by the health hazards linked to the eruption itself, the displacement to areas with pre-existing outbreaks, the lack of access to clean water, and the increased burden placed on health facilities.
Aid agencies warn that people in Goma are at increased risk of cholera, which is endemic in the region and easily spread in areas with poor hygiene and sanitation and insufficient clean water. The World Food Program reports it has started providing emergency food rations to thousands of people displaced from Goma. Based on assessments carried out over the past week, the WFP says it aims to reach 165,000 people in 3 cities of refuge. It says additional emergency food assistance is being provided to Congolese who have gone to Rwanda. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
In Ivory Coast, supporters of former President Laurent Gbagbo are anxiously awaiting his return now that it has been announced that Mr. Gbagbo will return on June 17. The announcement was made by Assoua Adou, Secretary General of Mr. Gbagbo's Ivorian Popular Front Party, following weeks of negotiations with the Ivorian government. June 17 coincides with Mr. Gbagbo's 76th birthday. The former president was acquitted for good in April this year by the International Criminal Court, the ICC, of crimes against humanity. Journalist Felix Boni in Abidjan says members of Mr. Gbagbo's family and political party are awaiting his return with great expectation.
It is not a surprise. The former president have been acquitted by the international justice, and the member of his party and his family are waiting for him here. And nothing can impeach him to come back to his country. Even the president Ouattara said that if he wants to come, he will come, and they will create all the conditions for him to come back in his country. So, and at this moment, his party said that he will come on the 17th of this month. This is the news which does not surprise anybody.
There was this suggestion that maybe the Ivorian government did not want to make a big deal about his return because they didn't want it to disrupt the flow of the government, that it could cause disruption. Can the Ivorian government control when he can return?
Really, the government can control the moment he will come, but then they contribute to create the condition of security, the condition of coming. The discussion takes place between the government and the members of the party of Mr. Gbagbo, his representative here in Cote d'Ivoire. But if they have given a date, it means that there has been an agreement about the day of his coming back. So I don't think there is another situation which can impeach Mr. Gbagbo to come back to his country. The president has been one of the first to say that Mr. Gbagbo can come free in his country.
So, Felix, how would you describe the mood among the former president's supporters, members of his party and his family members, and in Cote d'Ivoire itself? What are people saying about the fact that after so many years that Mr. Gbagbo is going to be returning?
You know, Mr. Gbagbo has been judged at the international court. He has been free for his family and also his political family and most of the Ivorian. It is a grateful event that he's come back into the country. You know, Mr. Gbagbo is one of the key of the reconciliation in this country. And for the Ivorian, the fact that all the leaders will be in the country, they will speak each other's, it is the best opportunity to make the reconciliation. So it is a grateful event for the Ivorian that the former president, Mr. Gbagbo, has been come back in his country to find his brothers in order to discuss together for reconciliation.
Mr. Gbagbo's supporters have been saying all along that they wanted him to return to Ivory Coast because that would facilitate reconciliation. I want you to talk about reconciliation, but also within Mr. Gbagbo's own party, I'm thinking that there is a lot of work to do to bring about reconciliation within Mr. Gbagbo's own party.
I think the comeback of Mr. Gbagbo will be the only one opportunity for his party to make reconciliation inside within this party. And Mr. Gbagbo will also be one of the important actors of reconciliation in Cote d'Ivoire. And we are waiting for him to know what we will do for this reconciliation. Mr. Gbagbo has passed 75 years. I think it is an opportunity for him to finish his political activities, to help Cote d'Ivoire to have reconciliation, to continue to be a peaceful country. This is why Ivorians are voting for him at this moment as one of the leaders who can help reconciliation to be a reality.
That was journalist Felix Boni speaking with us from the Ivorian capital, Abidjan. The Senegalese military bombarded the country's southern region this week in an offensive to stop what they say are rebel fighters who are trafficking in drugs and timber. The Movement of Democratic Process of Casamance has been fighting for independence of southern Senegal's Casamance region since 1982. Maurice Dupane is a researcher at the Institute for Security Studies.
The bombing attack of Senegalese army took place in the south of Casamance, on the border with Guinea-Bissau. According to some sources, this heavy weapon operation is directed at the Kassolol camp, commanded by Cesar Atoubad Badiat, one of the military leaders of the Movement of Democratic Force of Casamance, which has been leading an army independence rebellion since 1982. But these bombings are in fact a reaction of the military operation launched by the army earlier this year. And at that time, the army succeeded in taking control of three military bases on the border with Guinea-Bissau. It also should be noted that this operation is continued in the department of Binjona, bordering the Gambia, where the army destroyed the cannabis field and also took control of some checkpoints of the rebel group. In addition to this operation, we should highlight that the Senegalese army is also fighting against transnational organized crime, notably timber trafficking and drug trafficking, including cannabis in the Casamance region.
What are the stated purposes of this government bombardments in the region? You know, what has Macky Sall's administration said is the reason behind these?
According to the Senegalese authority, the aim of this operation is to create security conditions for the return of the Senegalese.
That was Maurice Dupane, a researcher at the Institute for Security Studies. He was speaking to Ricky Stryer from Dakar. And that's it for this Wednesday, June 2nd edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, I'm James Butte in Washington saying, have a nice day.